In every Barnes & Noble store, there's a prominently placed display case holding a collection of books under a banner that reads, Discover Great New Writers. The books in it are not easily definable by topic or category, but they have one thing in common. Each of them was written by a relatively new author, someone without a proven track record. The selection process is managed by Miwa Messer, the director of the Discover program, and she joins us now along with two Discover authors, Angela Flournoy, whose book The Turner House, published by Mariner, was a 2015 Discover pick and the second place prize winner in the fiction category that year, and Christian Radke, whose book Imagine Wanting Only This is a 2017 pick and will be published in April by Penguin. Welcome to our show.
Thank you. Thanks. We're happy to be here.
Thanks for having us.
Mia, what was the impetus behind the creation of the Discover program? You know, that was way before you were on
1990,
board.
Actually. 1990 is when we formed it. So it's been around for 26 years. And the idea was exactly that, to put writers that you might not necessarily find otherwise right in front of you.
And it started off really well. I checked the list of the 1990 Discover authors. They included, I can't go over all of them, but listen to this, Walter Mosley, Haruki Murakami, Barbara Kingsolver, Ian McEwan, Paul Auster, Neil Gaiman, and T.C. Boyle.
Right.
Wow.
And almost 1,900 authors later, that includes Hannah Tinty, Colson Whitehead, Mohsen Hamid, and Zadie Smith, among others.
Why not just stick to the bestsellers and let the market decide what book deserves a good place up front?
Because it's more fun to figure out what's new and what's coming.
And I'm assuming Kristen and Angela, that you appreciate that because new writers need a hand in getting attention?
Oh, absolutely. I think that getting to the front of the bookstore for more than the day that your book comes out, even on the day that your book comes out, is like a miracle. And so to be able to be in a visible place in the bookstore and have that real estate for longer than a week, and for the Discover program, it's what, 6 weeks?
12 weeks.
That's priceless.
Especially at a time when fewer newspapers and magazines are publishing reviews of books.
Yeah, and especially at a huge chain like Barnes & Noble. I mean, I grew up in a really small town. We drove, you know, half an hour to the Barnes & Noble, and it was our only bookstore. So it also felt like it gave my book some sort of kind of validation with my family. Like, my grandmother can go buy it now, which was a really special thing.
Is it even more difficult for a debut novel to get attention than a nonfiction book?
Actually, I would say there are times where that's the case. I mean, the kind of nonfiction that's being published now, it's either someone who's had a platform, whether that be online, whether that be film or television or even radio. Whereas fiction, you don't necessarily have that kind of access to a platform prior to publishing.
I remember when I first started doing this show and we started putting writers of fiction on, my program director said, why are you doing that? The audience hasn't read the book. They don't know the plot, as though that's the only thing you can talk about with a writer. As you were waiting for your books to be published, did you worry about things like marketing and shelf space?
Yes.
Right, yeah. Now.
Yeah, I'm still worrying about it. The sleep is getting less and less every night, I think.
Angela, have you found out that being an author is different from being someone who writes?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, being a capital A author is a lot of talking about your book. And it's difficult, I think, particularly for fiction writers, because for nonfiction, there is some way, usually, with exception, that you can perhaps paraphrase or summarize what your book is about. But for fiction writers, that can get hairy. You know, like, what it's about, to me, I've learned from talking to readers, is not necessarily what they think the book is about.
And a number of authors have come on the show and said, in reading the reviews, I learned all sorts of things about my intentions that I didn't even realize were there. Maybe they're there subconsciously, or maybe people are just reading things into it.
Mm-hmm. We hear that a lot at events, too, when audience members will have questions for our audience. And they'll say, well, did you mean to do this, this, and this? And you just sort of watch the author say, oh, I had not thought of that. It's part of why, as booksellers, we talk about the emotional response that you have to a book, or the experience of reading the book, and not necessarily going point by point, this is what the storyline is, these are the characters. It's more, hey, this is a book about the American dream, and you thought it was this, and in fact it's this. Or, this is how we build our families. It's more about finding the community.
And how important are opening sentences when you're evaluating a book?
Opening sentences are important, but actually opening pages are more important. Mm-hmm. I think in this day and age, it's an incredible help to not just booksellers, but reviewers and readers as well. If you have a strong opening and you're not saying, hey, it gets better at 100 pages in.
You have to believe in what you're doing. You and your booksellers have described this year's as the best book group ever, but I suspect you did that last year as well. How does the selection process work?
I have a team of readers. Some are based in New York, some are based outside of New York, and we get together weekly. And we parse through roughly 1,000 submissions a year.
So you're reading 1,000 books? Or different people reading different books.
Different people reading different books.
Forget this one.
In some cases, we all come together. There are certain books that become. It would be really useful to get multiple reads.
And how many people in the group?
Right now, we're at 22.
Uh-huh. And this is kind of like a reading group?
Oh, it's very much a reading group.
So
it's very much. So everyone's looking
at. Does it count as a reading group if you don't have a lot of wine?
We have a lot of coffee. That counts for something. We have a lot of coffee and a lot of opinions, and I think really that's the basis of any reading group is opinions.
And are these readers from all over the country?
Mm-hmm. They are.
I've met some of them all over the place. They come up to me at the end of readings, and they're like, I'm a Discover reader.
They're fantastic. Uh-huh. They are some of the smartest, funniest people I know, and I'm really, really grateful to be part of their orbit.
Are most of them booksellers?
Yes. It's a volunteer gig. I mean, it's not something that, you know, we put on business cards saying you're a Discover reader, but they all work for different parts of the company, so, and in stores as well.
Has the program changed in terms of the kinds of books that you see and consider? Were there graphic novels or YA books considered at the beginning?
Originally, it was focused, if I remember this correctly, and the program does predate my entire bookselling career, but it was focused solely on literary fiction. And then later on, memoir came in, and later on, narrative nonfiction came in, and then YA came in. We started doing graphic novels and graphic memoirs with The Gigantic Beard That Was Evil, which was a Picador title, and I think it was only a couple of years ago.
2012 or 2013.
Okay, yeah, so very, very recently.
But that must have heartened you, Kristen.
Yeah, I was very excited when I saw that. It's also a beautiful book.
Don't you have a book coming onto the list that's categorized as cooking?
So
is it a cookbook?
It's not a straight-up cookbook. This is more an examination of how Southern cooking has evolved from the slave tradition and from continental Africa.
Don't many readers select nonfiction books by topic as much as by the author? We can tell from the fiction bestseller list that certain authors are on it whenever their books come out, whether they're good or not so good. Well, you shrugged, but, you know, not everybody writes a masterpiece every time.
Yes, but we're delighted to have everyone.
How would you characterize a book that's a good candidate for this program?
Oh, it's a combination of voice and story and really spectacular writing. And we joke, actually, in the Discover Room, and it's not that much of a joke, but we know it when we see it.
Must they be accessible? I'm thinking because right now the Leonard Lopate Book Club is doing a three-part series on James Joyce's Ulysses, and people have a hard time getting through. Would that have made the list?
No, actually, it wouldn't. I will own that right now. I have never finished Ulysses. I loved Dubliners.
You might
absolutely
try it.
Loved it.
You might try it by checking out what we're offering.
Well, that I'm happy
cheat
to
sheets
do.
And all.
Yeah, that I'm very, very happy to
Wait,
do.
Wait, there are cheat sheets.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
This
to help
be
you get
my
through.
Chance to finish finally, too.
Well, because there are some obscure things in the book, and we want to help people get through it.
We're nice. Looking for books where actually style is in service of story. So we're looking for beautiful writing, but, yeah, honestly, Ulysses is much more about style than it is about story.
But I think my day job is I work at Saraband Books. I'm the managing editor there. We're a really small press. Miwa and her team selected a book in 2014, mm-hmm. Elegy on Kinderklavier by Arno Bontemps Hemingway, which is a collection of short stories with a novella on the end. And I would say it's a relatively challenging book, and I feel like they really gave it a platform to sort of kind of usher in sort of the general reader.
We're going to take a little break, and when we come back, I'm going to talk to Angela and Kristen about their books, and we will continue this conversation about discovering new writers. I've always wondered why somebody comes out with a fabulous book and it just disappears, or vice versa, something has a gets a lot of attention, and then 10 years later, nobody even remembers that it existed, while another book, To Kill a Mockingbird, goes on forever. My guests are Miwa Messer, who is the director of the Discover program at Barnes & Noble, to discover great new writers, and two of the writers who have been discovered, Angela Flournoy, author of The Turner House, and Kristen Radke, author of Imagine Wanting Only This. Stay with us for more. And we are back with our discussion of the Discover Great New Writers program at the Barnes & Noble chain with Miwa Messer, who's the director of the program, and two of the authors who have been chosen, Angela Flournoy, whose book The Turner House was a 2015 pick, and Kristen Radke, whose Imagine Wanting Only This is a 2017 pick. So, Angela, you were here to talk about your novel, The Turner House, your debut novel?
Yes.
Have you written any other since?
Not completely. I'm slowly but surely working on the second book.
But you no longer qualify for the Discover program.
Oh, that's actually not true. We're not limited to debuts at all. We'll look at people's second or third or fourth books. Once we pick you, we won't pick you a second time, but we will go out and promote whatever comes next. But we're not limited to debuts. We're really looking for people who might not just have had their hit yet.
I was just wondering whether it's a problem for someone who has a powerhouse first book like The Turner House, which has done so well, won awards.
Well, luckily we chose it.
And do you think that being chosen caused people to pay more attention to you?
Certainly. If it forced them, I'm fine with that too. Absolutely. I think for similar reasons as Kristen, I didn't grow up in a rural community, but I grew up in a suburban one. And Barnes & Noble is the only bookstore around. And so I know that locally, having being visible in so many suburban communities across the country, it has been beneficial. And I actually had a little mini book tour after my paperback came out at a couple Barnes & Nobles throughout the country. And was able to meet people who I wouldn't have met otherwise.
Your book was set in Detroit, mm-hmm. a city that has experienced a serious decline, but people still reading books?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. They do not have a Barnes & Noble inside of Detroit, but they do have some nearby in the suburbs, and I've had good experiences. Every time I'm in Detroit, a wide variety of readers are there.
And the Turner House is a compelling story from the very first page. Miwa, is that the case with the books that you're attracted to? Do some just sneak up on you?
Some do sneak up on you. One of the things about working with this team of readers, we're working with physical galleys in a lot of cases, and things might sit on the table a little longer than other things, and all it takes is one reader. And I have watched in this room, and it's a really big conference room table, and I've watched these readers change each other's minds. Someone can say, oh, no, you think it's this, it's not, boom, and then the next sort of string happens, and it's really exciting.
Angela, you have a lot of stuff in that book. This is a story of a family, 13 children, although you don't focus on all of them. You include the 67 riots, mm-hmm. inspired, I assume, partly by the fact that you were in California during the Rodney King riots?
I was in Southern California, in the L.A. area, for those.
And this is about some people who choose to stay, others to leave. There's also a haint.
Yes.
Are all families and places haunted?
That is something that I've been thinking about. I do think that a lot of families are haunted by something, not every family, but that might be by a secret or maybe be by a certain memory or legacy. And I don't necessarily think that being haunted is a negative thing always, but I do think that there are things that kind of linger around people. And some of us are better at kind of looking at those things and accepting them or dealing with them than others, for sure.
Kristen, how would you describe your book, Imagine Wanting Only This? Is it fair to say it's a memoir and an essay and a meditation presented in graphic form?
Yeah. I initially had never conceived of it as a memoir. That was a much later part of the process. My editors really encouraged it to be more personal. Initially, I just thought it was going to be a collection of essays about abandoned places.
But connected by, as it turns out, looking at a particular time in your life, young mm-hmm. adulthood. How old were you when your beloved uncle died?
I was a sophomore in college, so I was 19.
Did that death from a genetic problem with his heart, which you potentially share, influence the decisions that you made going forward? Is that?
I think it certainly made me a lot more restless. So much of the project in the book is about restlessness, and I think I sort of saw the sense of that in the way that so many places, whether they're just neighborhoods or whole towns, have been sort of abandoned and left to ruin throughout the states and the world.
So you wound up visiting those abandoned and destroyed places?
Yes.
What were you looking for?
Who knows? I think at first I just wanted to be anywhere I'd never been before. That was really, I always felt like if there was any way I could save up enough money for a ticket or convince some organization to foolishly give me a grant, there was really no place I wouldn't go.
Could this story have been told in any other format?
Yeah. I resist the idea that there's a right medium for any project. This is just the medium that made sense to me at the time.
I felt in an odd way that the pictures made the story more manageable. What's the impulse and the advantage of telling a story in this form?
For me, it was just about how I could negotiate the pieces that I had to place together. I have a day job. I can come home at the end of the day and I can draw. I can't necessarily write a really good paragraph. So part of it too was I felt like just self-preservation. You know, it was a different part of my brain than I was using for 10 hours a day at work.
And also for our purposes, I had people who don't usually read graphically, who loved Imagine Wanting Only This and immediately understood that they were reading a memoir about grief and loneliness and needing to belong. And that's what we're looking for.
Well, the world has changed since Art Spiegelman's Mouse came out.
Yeah.
And I remember that I had just started doing this show and I wanted to do it. And I had a different producer than the one I have now. And I said, this is a great book. We have to have him on as a guest. He said, it's a comic book.
Oh,
well, we had him on. I had to get down on my hands and knees and beg, but it's okay. We had him on. That has changed the world of publishing
absolutely,
as well.
Absolutely. We have an entire generation of readers who've grown up reading graphic novels and manga and graphic memoirs, and I think it's terrific. I think anything that will bring more people to story is a marvelous thing.
So where do you, after it's put in this this case for 12 weeks...
After I have to let it go back
into
the...
Where do you put it in the bigger store?
It depends.
It's not a graphic novel.
You know, in this case, off the top of my head, I think we're going to split it between biography and graphic novels, even though it's a memoir. But honestly, I didn't look before I came down here. So.
Angela, were you and Kristen at Iowa at the same time?
We were.
Did you know each other?
Yes. Kristen, you were in the nonfiction program,
was.
Right? I remember I have this very vivid memory, which maybe is embarrassing.
I have no idea what you're going to say.
Kristen painting her nails while a softball game was going
on.
The poets versus fiction writer softball game. And I was sitting there wishing I had brought something as constructive to do.
I will tell you that it was a huge failure. And because it was so hot, it was like a bubbly, disgusting mess. So,
but I also didn't want to be in the game. So I was like, I should have done something not athletic, but useful with my time.
You going to write about this in another book?
Maybe.
As on top of the shelf space, doesn't Discover offer a monetary prize?
That's a piece of the program. So we choose about 50 titles a year, and we release 3 seasonal lists. Mostly that's a way of managing submissions, to be perfectly honest, because we're updating the display monthly with new titles. But when you're talking about 638 stores and 35,000 booksellers and 1,000 books taken down to 50, you need to have systems.
And who judges for the prize?
Well, here's the thing. So I go out into the world and I ask 6 writers who are bigger than Discover to say, would you mind doing this for us? Would you mind looking at this list of books that we are wild about? So we've got 3 fiction, 3 nonfiction, and they have a year to read. And then they come back and they say, well, this is our short list of 3 titles. And then they say, this is our prize ranking. So the first place receives $30,000, second place receives $15,000, and third place receives $7,500. And we do it for both fiction and non. And we do that each March. So this year's winners actually were Matthew Desmond for nonfiction for Evicted, Poverty and Profit in the American City, and Abby Gini's novel, The Lightkeepers. So we were really delighted with those selections.
We have a link on our show page to 4 short videos where either a bookseller or a judge discusses a favorite book. And out of those 6 books, 4 were featured on our show. The other 2 were greenlighted by but we just couldn't work them in, or the person wasn't available.
I think both of those authors didn't come through New York originally for their hardcovers, if I remember correctly.
Mm-hmm. So what happened, Angela, after you won this? Well, you've won a whole bunch of awards
Can
since.
Can we talk about the finalist for the National Book Award part?
Yeah, a finalist for the National Book Award. You were named a New York Times Notable Book, Best Book of the Year by O, the Oprah Magazine, Entertainment Weekly, NPR, Essence, Men's Journal, BuzzFeed, Bustle, Time Out, Denver Post, Publishers Weekly, Kirkus Reviews, Book Page, Literary Hub, Kobo, The Week.
So Aren't Barnes & Noble must have known what the Penn Award?
I was.
Yeah. Oh, that didn't make it on the cover.
So the Discover Prize, I think it's important for working writers to talk about, like, how do they actually live. Absolutely. I will say that the Discover Prize, although I was a runner-up and I got the 15,000 versus the 30,000, I felt like a winner. And they give you the check. And I cashed the check. I thought someone was going to rob me on the train, but I made it to cash the check. And I honestly think that was sort of like the first like headwind in my life as a professional writer, feeling like I could perhaps plan for more than like 3 years. I could sign my lease for my apartment, was knowing that I had this money. So it was
And you
no
didn't
small
have to
thing.
Work on the side to work on your next while well, working on your next book.
I'm never not working on the side, so I won't say, but that's more about my, once you've sort of gone through your 20s, like needing all these jobs so that you could pursue writing, you can't turn that off. I'm trying to slowly, but for sure that money kind of changed really the rest of the year for me, and still is.
Miwa, haven't you just announced your summer pick?
We have.
What should we look
we
for?
We have. For fiction, there's a stunning novel of 1980s New York and young obsessive love called White Fur that's coming at the end of May. I am going to look at the rest of my notes here so I don't miss anything. There's if you like books about books and puzzles, there's Midnight at the Bright Ideas Bookstore, where a bookseller, an intrepid bookseller, solves the mysterious death of a patron. Let's see, what else did I have on this list? There's something else. Oh, The Mighty Franks, Michael Frank's memoir of growing up with his eccentric Hollywood family. That also coming in May. And those are...
Well, we'll post it. You give it to my staff and we'll post it all on our website.
There's actually a lot to choose from. We have 20 titles publishing between May and August, and they're all pretty spectacular.
Now, I mentioned earlier that we are featuring James Joyce's Ulysses on the London Lopate Book Club, called The Greatest Novel Never Read. Kristen, it's actually mentioned in Imagine Wanting Only This twice.
Twice, yeah.
So how much have you read? What is the context?
I read the whole thing, but a long time ago, so please don't ask me like what happens on page 203 or anything. I mean, it's mentioned in my book sort of facetiously. You know, I was a pretty pretentious college student with my pretentious friends just trying to sort of beat each other with the, you know, difficult things.
And I
read
Ulysses all exactly. the way through.
Yeah.
Well, you're a publisher. You probably appreciate the fact that that is not a book that would be easily published today.
Yeah, it's true.
So that's what your day job is, publishing?
Mm-hmm.
And Angela, you teach?
I do teach. I'm not teaching right now. I have a fellowship at the New York Public Library at the Coleman Center there, which is great, and it's coming to an end, and I have to reckon with that. But I get space in the library and access to the collection, the branch, the Schwarzman Building at Bryant Park, and just to work on the next book and research.
Now, Miwa, I mentioned some of the famous writers who won the first prize in 1990. Who were some of the others over the years?
Oh, Anthony Doerr has won, Cheryl Strayed, Joshua Ferris won 1 year. I'm doing this all from memory.
Yes. Jhumpa Lahiri?
No, actually, she was a pick. Uh-huh. She was a pick, but she wasn't. There's a difference between being selected for the program and actually winning the award. But it's all available, actually, at bn.com/discover. We have the complete archive there by year, which makes it really, really helpful. You know, and I just realized, too, there are two other books that I really, really would like to mention for the summer. The City Always Wins by Omar Robert Hamilton, which is an extraordinary novel set in Tahrir Square in 2011 that's coming from McD. And then also a Lizzie Borden novel. This is the best idea ever. See What I Have Done. This book creepy can be a compliment, this is the book where creepy is a compliment. It is not to be missed, and that's August.
The editor didn't take an axe to that book.
No, the editor did not, but I don't think the editor needed to, because this author clearly, Sarah Schmidt, knew exactly what she was doing, so it's really fabulous.
Now, just one more thing before you go. Bookstores are in trouble, although I just read recently that they're making something of a comeback. Do you know why?
You know, books are always going to be part of our cultural conversation. And I think one of the great things about reading, especially, I mean, for me personally, I've been a reader my entire life, is that connection that you have and being part of something that is bigger than you and knowing that there's a world outside of whatever your square footage is. I mean, I happen to have grown up half Asian in South Suburban Massachusetts, so books were a really good thing for me.
Mima Messer is the director of the Discover program at Barnes & Noble, and we've been talking to two of the authors who've been chosen in recent years to be discovered, Christian Radke and Angela Flournoy. Thank you all for being on our show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.